It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 148. The second most handsome doctor in North America is back with us, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, man. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
It really has. I've been on a kick just interviewing and rapping with all the heavy hitters of the strength conditioning field. That's been fun. We're not running out of content. I just want to let the internet know.
We can make shit up forever. So, you know.
Well, these people are busy, right? So like I've got an upcoming podcast with Daniel Lieberman, who wrote the book Exercised, recorded with Ponzer. But it's like you got to plan these things months in advance because they're like actually doing stuff. They're not just sitting around waiting to get on a podcast. And we want to keep bringing you content. So in any case, that's not why we brought Austin back. The internet wanted you. And
I just haven't had that much to say for a while, you know, so.
Well, I liked when I introduced you, you had like a 30-second sigh that just overlapped. I don't know if the audio is going to pick that up, but that's funny. Yeah. This podcast is brought to you by us. We don't do any sort of ad reads or anything like that. Although I will say that our support box staff, I think what they're doing is they're just leaving more of these social media influencer campaign things in my inbox and just waiting for me to see them and get triggered, like a Manscaped thing or whatever.
Yes, all the influencer pitches the other thing is how annoyingly persistent these people are. So I typically ignore them, and then a few days or a week later, hey, just checking in to see if you got my last email. It's like, gonna ignore this one too.
Yeah, and it doesn't even stop in the emails. I get them in my DMs too. Like Doctor's Best slid in my DMs and they were like, hey, do you want to promote a new multivitamin that's coming out? And I was like, no. And I have other problems. Like, one, your brand name's Doctor's Best. That insinuates that you have other clinicians, physicians who are, you know, behind your brand. Like, just use them to show your product. Two, like, what recent discoveries in the in multivitamin sort of research have come out? Because as far as I can tell, based on all the research, most people do not need to take a multivitamin because they don't do anything, meaning that it doesn't improve health outcomes, doesn't reduce the risk of, you know, certain disease processes. There are a handful of folks, you know, relatively small percentage of folks who are at risk of a bona fide micronutrient or vitamin deficiency due to like a GI surgery or procedure or other medical condition. And those folks are prescribed multivitamins. But otherwise, if you're generally healthy, or even if you have a chronic comorbidity that doesn't really affect absorption of food from the gut, you know, taking a multivitamin doesn't do anything, and there's a risk of contamination plus costs. So if you haven't yet heard one of my rants on multivitamins, that's it. I don't recommend multivitamins even for very, very active individuals. That's just the idea of taking more vitamins than needed is, not health promoting. In fact, the opposite in some cases. I don't think taking a multivitamin is necessarily harmful to your health, provided that it's not contaminated and provided that you're not like mega dosing certain vitamins, but it's certainly not helping anything. So no benefit and some element of risk, generally a bad sort of risk benefit ratio, 10 out of 10, would not recommend. Okay. Didn't mean to start this with a rant, but here we are. Other updates. So we are getting back into the apparel game in a big way. Basically, we've hired some new people to step up our apparel side, because basically what we do is we would make a run of shirts and then run out of shirts or gear or whatever. And then people would be like, when are you coming back in stock? And it's like, well, yeah, got to plan this a little bit better. But realize we need to get some sort of dedicated staff on that. So new shirt designs, new apparel is going to be dropping. This is the middle of July, should be by the end of the month. So make sure to keep on lookout for that. We'll be doing some cool new stuff on that end. And then, let's just get into this. So life update, Dr. Baracchi is back. What's going on, man? Everything okay? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Doing my normal thing, working in the hospital and working on all these other side projects we have going when I'm not in the hospital. I was fortunate enough to recently see both you and Leo when you guys came, and I guess my wife organized a big surprise birthday for me earlier this week. Dude, earlier this month.
Yeah. She went behind your back and she said, we're going to get Austin's friends to come hang out.
She got me good. we got our first seminar back on the circuit coming up soon in San Antonio. So we're going to have the whole crew the band's getting back together again, as I say.
Yeah, that's right. It's a reunion tour. Yeah, we're going to be in San Antonio here in about 3 weeks, and then Philadelphia in October, and then November we'll be at Alan Thrall's place in Sacramento, Train Untamed. So we haven't done a seminar. Has it been a year?
No, we did some over the winter during like little pockets of downtrends in COVID numbers and things like that. Here we snuck a few here and there, but not consistently since last year. Yeah,
it's been an entire gestational period, I think, since we've done a seminar. And like most of our seminar material, things keep getting updated over time. I think this is probably not as big of a change from maybe our very first seminar to our second seminar.
Sure.
I just think that was like, okay, here are all our objectives. Here's how we failed. Here's how we can make it better. But since we've had so much downtime, a lot of our stuff's gotten updated. What are you most excited about for the upcoming seminar?
I think probably the biggest topic that is going to be revamped in how it's presented and taught is going to be the obesity discussion. And, yeah, you know, we've been going back and forth a lot on this. I know I've probably been annoying you with how much I'm prodding you on the topic of how we pitch this to people and how we frame it. And I think that there's, you know, some differences in how, you know, you might communicate the topic to, you know, an audience who is already like heavily bought into the fitness gym training scene compared to like quote unquote gen pop. But I think that regardless, I think the overarching concepts that we're hoping to get across are going to be kind of updated, brought more into line with like kind of the current best practices. And, you know, it actually ends up being a pretty stark departure from a lot of the conversation around obesity, its causes and how you approach it, that you hear in the fitness gym bro world, you know, people who are already bought into this and feel like, you know, they are, you know, better people because they're able to exert, you know, such self-control and stuff like that. That, you know, that's like a common way that this stuff gets discussed, and just, you know, count macros harder and things like that.
You're right.
So we're going to be framing and discussing this, I think, in a way that is more accurate or closer to reality for most of the general population, and not just, you know, towards already highly motivated gym bro folks.
Yeah. I mean, the people who come to our seminars in general are highly motivated folks. In general, they're very active. They're already bought into exercise. They are already knowledgeable, if not actively participating in health promoting dietary patterns. There may need to be some additional refinement there to maximize or improve their own health trajectory and health span, or increase their fund of knowledge with working with others to improve their health span or improve their performance from a, you know, dietary intervention perspective, or from a training perspective, or from some of the other topics that we cover. So previously in our obesity lecture, the way we kind of introduced this topic, which was after the behavioral change, after sarcopenia, after like what is health lectures, we were principally talking about energy balance. And I think we probably focused a little too much on downstream sort of inputs into energy balance. So just as an overview, like what we're talking about is energy balance is the relationship between energy intake and energy expenditure. And we would focus on the biological, psychological, social, and environmental sort of factors that go into this sort of energy balance or energy imbalance. Now, when the way we're kind of moving into describing this and addressing it, I think makes more sense. It's more upstream. We're talking about higher level things. And I think it just makes it easier to understand, easier to communicate, and then ultimately easier to sort of guide management. So what do you do? So the 10,000 foot view here is that we more view this as an appetite dysregulation problem rather than just than try to describe all these downstream mechanisms. So when we view this from an appetite dysregulation standpoint, there are certain modifiable and then non-modifiable factors. We can't really modify somebody's genetics, but we can certainly try to modify their environment. Not necessarily all aspects of their environment. That's kind of limited by the individual, maybe their socioeconomic status, etc. But certain aspects of their immediate, you know, sort of eating environment, or at a larger level, their food environment. There's lifestyle stuff that we can employ, you know, depending on the individual. And so by correcting or trying to improve this appetite dysregulation thing, then we get people who are more satiated, so more full, will tend to eat less and lower their sort of dietary intervention RPE, make it easier for them to eat less, or consume less energy. And basically, when you look at it through that lens, obesity is sort of like this multifaceted disease. It's an umbrella term for a bunch of different types or different causes of that disease. So there are straight up pure genetic causes of obesity. So like leptin resistance, that genetic cause. There are, you know, things that are more related to like a food addiction thing, although that's a controversial term. There are things related more to mood disorders, and the classification of which is, again, an active area of research. So but we think if we look at it through this appetite dysregulation lens, and then address food environment and address lifestyle factors and potentially different medical agents, so liraglutide, semaglutide, other sort of pharmacotherapy, potentially even surgery, and there are new indications for who gets evaluated for bariatric surgery. All of these things sort of work by fixing the appetite thing first, whereas people then will start responding more better and be more sensitive to these satiety signals. And then they end up spontaneously reducing their energy intake because now they're getting the signal like, hey, we've got too much energy on board. We can actually reduce our energy intake. So rather than just telling somebody to eat less and move more, or, you know, just try harder, or, you know, ascribing excess adiposity as a failure of willpower, what we're trying to get across is that, you know, obesity is a complex disease. It's, there are many different types. It's not a sort of personal failing of an individual, but rather sort of, again, you're set up with this genetic susceptibility in a particular environment and, you know, multiple factors that have all summed together to create this issue. And so if we come at it from this appetite dysregulation standpoint, I think we're going to be able to have more success in actually managing this issue and identifying certain treatments, behavior change targets, et cetera, that are likely to be more successful.
Yeah, the caveats that I think I like framing it in through the lens of we don't choose to be hungry and we don't choose when we feel full or satiated from a meal. And, you know, I don't think I would necessarily frame it as like people's regulation systems being broken, but rather that when they have it, when they're kind of genetically set up in a particular way to have this, you know, appetite hunger spectrum, it's primarily that in the context of the modern environment that's like full of like, you know, readily available, calorie dense, super tasty, hyper palatable foods and things like that. If, you know, we could snap our fingers and change the food environment pretty, you know, significantly, then I think these genetic underpinnings would end up resulting in a vastly different kind of landscape of, you know, how people end up, you know, kind of progressing through their health span over time, and who might develop obesity, who might not, who might be selected for from like an evolutionary perspective, who might be selected against, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's a big, the big push, you know, in the kind of academic discussion of the obesity landscape is really centering on this combination of the genetics and the environmental factors, controlling what you can, and then recognizing the things you can't control and treating it as a disease like any other. You know, you mentioned that there's a bunch of different ways, a bunch of different subtypes. It's kind of like having high blood pressure. You know, you can have high blood pressure. I could start listing all the different ways people could end up with high blood pressure and go on for quite a while here. And those are evaluated and treated differently. And we don't, you know, blame the person for like squeezing their arteries down too tight and tell them to just like, tell them like, have you tried relaxing your blood vessels more or something like
just
that?
Relax.
Right? Just, yeah. So, just, you dilate. Know, it helps to destigmatize this. Cause honestly, like if you look at the rates of success of just like telling people eat less, move more, doesn't really, you know, on a population level, doesn't seem to be particularly effective. And so just telling people to do that harder isn't going to make it any more effective. And we are seeing pretty substantial breakthroughs you know, in the biomedical arena when it comes to interventions that specifically treat this kind of appetite regulation system, whether through behavioral interventions that address it, or, you know, medication, surgical interventions that address the appetite regulation thing, people suddenly, and I've had, you know, some of my patients, some of my telemedicine patients that I work with, they might be dealing with, you know, a little excess body fat, and they're, maybe they've struggled, you know, to manage that over time. And then we say, okay, we're going to escalate, you know, our interventions, and we try some of the more recent medications that have become available to aid in the appetite regulation system. And suddenly, you know, they start losing a bunch of weight, and they're like, wow, this is like way easier than any other diet that I've tried before. I can stick to it, and I'm not just like ravenously hungry all the time, having like to exert this massive, you know, conscious restraint, high RPE diet kind of thing. And instead, you know, it becomes a more regulated, better regulated system that allows them to, in the setting of the modern environment, which we have a limited ability to modify, to still achieve, you know, a more healthful kind of body composition and improve some of their, you know, any complications like lowering their blood pressure, blood sugar, things like that. So that's like a, I guess, a little brief overview, but we're going to get into things in a whole lot more detail, both, I think, at the seminar lecture. I've been designing a lecture that I'm going to give, given that it's a new academic year for medical trainees. So I have new medical students under me. I have new interns under me, new residents that I'm working with. And so, you know, some educational content I'm going to be teaching them when we're working in the hospital too. So,
yeah, turns out writing a book has opened our eyes more to, I wouldn't necessarily call it like a blind spot, like, oh, we just, you know, ignored this stuff before. But when you start getting deeper into like, okay, well, what's causing this? Or like, how, you know, why are some people more susceptible to weight gain or weight regain or whatever? Yeah. And then you start, it changes your perspective. You know, previously, you know, the recommendation would be, well, you got to find a way to be in a calorie deficit to lose the weight. And, you know, you're going to do that with diet and exercise and then maybe some meds and plus or minus surgery if you need it. And I think that's not wrong technically, but as far as how understanding like, well, how do people get here? And like, what's the principal thing you need to address? I think that's just not a great explanation.
Yeah, I think we're just moving further upstream as far as like the causes and things like that. And the higher upstream you can get, the more effective your intervention will end up becoming downstream.
Cool. So we'll just go to straight environment. Just look, we got to go to a different planet and set the food environment up in such a way. There's no marketing for a highly energy dense, you know, ultra processed, hyper palatable foods. And no. Okay. They'll probably edit that out. All right. So we got upcoming seminars, talked about that. Now, finally, what everyone wants to know, how's training? How strong are you right now? Your internet reputation depends on this.
I would say I am reasonably strong at the moment. I have in recent past few months, I think since probably like the beginning of the year, I was getting kind of annoyed with, you know, standard highly powerlifting specific training at the time. And so I said, I'm going to, you know, back away a little bit. And so I introduced a bit more variation, which we do from time to time. But this time I kind of put more variation in my main lifts and I started training those as if they're main lifts. And so people probably noticed that for the past 6 months or so, I haven't really been low bar squatting, been training the high bar squat, which I haven't really, I think like before this past winter, I'd only ever done high bar squats for eights. And I'd done like 460 or 470 for eight. And like, that was, you know, it. I'd never done anything for fewer reps. So since then I started training much fewer reps. So I think I hit like 507 for six, and I've done 562 for a single on high bar. And I'd like to hit a 600 high bar squat, which I think would be kind of cool. Been training the reverse grip bench press, which always gets the people going. It seems
what's the purpose of a reverse grip bench?
yeah, I get that. I seem to get that question a lot. Like, what's that for? What does it do? And I'm like, do you ask this question about any other lift? Do you ask the question of what's the purpose of a squat? What's the purpose of a deadlift? It's just a movement that is consistent with your goals and you can get better at it. It's just, you know, another version of a bench. Who decided that a regular grip bench press has your hands turned prone? What if back in the day, somebody decided a regular grip bench was with your hands facing you? Then everybody would be asking, what's that other grip doing? You know,
this would be a great coffee table book. Like, how did we get here?
Yeah, right.
Like, who's the first person to do a back squat, and why was that the preferred you
right,
know,
exactly. Yeah.
Versus a front squat or whatever.
Yeah. So I've reverse grip benched 405, which was a cool milestone to hit. I've been training more sumo deadlift. I've been doing both sumo and conventional every week. And so I've been also set more kind of arbitrary goals for myself. And I said I wanted to hit on my day one. I've been doing like a high bar squat single, a reverse grip bench single, and a paused sumo deadlift single. And between the three, I wanted to hit a 1600 gym total in a given day. So I did that a couple weeks ago. So that's kind of where I'm at more or less at the moment, just training, and it's fun. I'm not interested in competing anytime soon. But I'd like to high bar 600 and then maybe eventually PR my low bar squat again someday. It's been a little while on that front. So
at some point, yeah. Set APR.
Whenever I, yeah, can care enough to really push that hard. So
yeah.
The other thing is I've been back in the pool, which I think, I don't know if I brought that up. Yeah. So a few months ago, my wife convinced me to get back in the pool and for like a day just to go have some fun. And since then I've been actually going once or twice a week and swimming, which I hadn't done in like about 10 years or so. Over 10 years was the last time I was in a pool. So I've been going once or twice a week and swimming like anywhere between 500 and 1,000 meters, which is, might sound like a lot, but for, you know, anybody who has swam competitively, it's like a tenth of what I would have done in, you know, routine training before. Normal practice might have been like 5,000 to 7,500, something like that. So a very short distance, and it's been coming back and it's feeling pretty good and doesn't seem to be impairing my performance in the gym either. So, you know, the variation, I think, all around, both in the exercise selection with the in the gym, the barbell, doing some isolation stuff, and then getting back in the pool, just moving more and in different ways is feeling good. And I'm having less kind of aches and pains and injuries arise and stuff like that. So that's been my big change in the past 6 to 9 months.
Probably also in just enjoying your time spent training, because there's less pressure, I guess, about, you know, how you're going to perform on lifts that we've given an arbitrary importance to, like the, you know, because the squat, bench, deadlift are the powerlifting, you know, specific movements, and we compete in powerlifting from time to time. It's like every time you do them, you're like, even if you aren't consciously or thinking about it or vocalizing like, okay, well, today, you know, this is an important squat session, you know, like historical performances, you know, like what you would, your expectation for your performance should be. Anything below that is like bad, quote unquote.
Yep.
Anything above that is good. And then, you know, that can set the tone for how your training is going. If you have a number of bad sessions in a row, you're like, oh, what is going on, man? And it's frustrating and whatever. And if you just change the movement, or alternatively, you can change the rep scheme. You're like, I've never done this rep scheme before, or change the context where you're doing something else beforehand. And you're like, oh, well, I'm fatigued. So it's not a rationalization or a way to cope necessarily. It's just a way to change the expectation and ultimately make it matter a little bit less to you. So I don't know.
Yeah. Everything I've done on those variations has been a PR pretty much. So that makes it kind of cool,
which is fun. Yep. I have been training. My training is actually, not that you asked, but
I just assumed you would follow.
Sure. Yes. That's how conversations work. my training has actually been going reasonably well on my squat and my bench. I'm circling around PR levels without peaking, which is kind of nice.
And you've been doing insane work at like bench stuff. You were telling me you're doing like, 14 singles at 395 or something.
Yeah, exactly. Which is the cool thing is like nothing feels heavy anymore, because it's just like, I've just been doing this. I don't know that I love this style of training, because I think my personal bias would be like, I want to work up to like one heavy set, one heavy single, and then do back down work, where it's that way it's easier for me to focus for that short period of time rather than like maintain focus. Yeah. But, you know, my work capacity is relatively high right now, and I don't know.
Sometimes I'll program those kind of like multiple singles across, not necessarily 14, but multiple across for people who tend to overshoot consistently, because you can't overshoot like
multiple singles
in a row. Whereas if it's just one, then you can rationalize, I'll push it a little higher.
What was not this past week, because I was ill. We'll talk about that in a second. But the week before I had, it was 12 singles. And normally the way I do that is my like indicator weight for bench press is like 365 if I'm using pound plates, or 374 if I'm using kilo plates. Basically, if 365 moves really fast where I can't rate it anything higher than like an RP 5 or 5.5, I'm probably just going to 405 and then whatever. If it moves heavier than that, I'm like, I'll take 385 and see how that feels. So, but the, if I have 12 singles and it's supposed to be at RP 7, typically what I do is I go 315, 365, and then pick a weight. So anyway, I went 315, 365, 405, and I was just doing these singles probably every 3 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever. And, after it was maybe 8 or 9, I thought maybe I was like, I don't know that I'm going to miss my 10th rep, but it's going to be like, hard.
Yeah.
So I was like, the goal for this workout is not to hit a max single. The goal is to get practice at singles at a submaximal weight. So I could either try and rest longer and like generate some more chutzpah, or I could just go back down to 365 or, you know, and bang out these three singles. And I just went down to 365. So I think, you know, if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, you can take down the weight, it's like, yep. It's totally fine. I mean, the idea is you have more existing fatigue on board and you're still just trying to hit the goals for the session. And that's what I did. And it was fine. But 405 doesn't feel heavy in my hands anymore, which is...
That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a good day when you unrack it and you're like, oh, yeah, this is going to be good. But no, this last week... So this is your fault again. I just want to let you know that every bad training like experience I've had is somehow your fault.
I mean, you're fine to pin that on me. That's fine.
Yeah. Shout out to 2015 when your infectious, you know, glute... pain infected me for 7 months. You had mentioned like 2 weeks ago, you were like, yeah, dude, I got this really weird, like I'm nauseous, abdominal pain. I can't eat anything. I'm tired because I'm not eating anything or whatever. Guess I'll train. And then you just, you know,
pulled 650 for a double.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And when we came down to see you for your birthday, I felt fine. And when I got back, I was like, I remember I woke up Monday morning and I was like, I'm not hungry. And normally I'm like, that's the first thing I want to do is eat food. I was like, I'm not hungry. I'll make myself eat, whatever. It's not a big deal. Ate breakfast. I've never been more nauseous. I mean, I'm obviously overstating this, but I was like, this is bad. This is bad. This is bad. 3 days of, you know, followed of not eating anything, super nauseous, abdominal pain, you know, all the rest. I was like, why did Austin do this to me? Everything was going so well. So I missed my first session in 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last previous one was like New Year's Eve, like the sequelae to New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Have to start the clock again. But this brings up a bigger question is about training when sick. We've talked about this a few times, just like it both in Instagram posts and then podcasts or whatever, but I feel like we can give it a little bit of the barbell medicine treatment here. And I was actually thinking about this while I was ill. I started The Wire, and in between these hour long episodes and waxing and waning consciousness, I was like, I wonder really if I had to tell somebody, you know, should they train when they're sick and give them like a nuanced answer, how would I do this? So, okay, I think if we start with just like the general overview of like how does exercise affect the immune system, whatever. I know we already have a podcast on this, so if you guys really want to dive in deep, but also you would take people through like what does exercise do to the immune system? What is the immune system, and then what does exercise do to it?
Yeah, the brief overview is that the immune system is the numerous interacting kind of components in our bodies that serve to defend us against pathogens. And pathogens are things that can cause disease, basically, usually infectious agents like viruses or bacteria, fungus, things like that. And we get asked, I would say, a fair amount of questions because the assumption is that doing any amount of physical exertion will like weaken your immune system.
That's right.
That's not necessarily the right takeaway, I think, from this. We do get into this a fair amount more in our podcast on this particular topic. But, you know, exercise has, numerous effects on multiple systems all throughout the body, not just the immune system, on the cardiovascular system, on the, you know, endocrine, you know, all kinds of hormones and muscles and a variety of things. And so to the extent that there are some impacts on immune function after, you know, a reasonable amount of exercise, meaning like not people who in the ultra endurance realm would be diagnosed with, like, quote, the overtraining syndrome.
Right.
People who are, you know, regular folks doing a reasonable amount of training. Exercise actually seems to ramp up some immune activity, certain immune functions. It tends to wake up certain cells that will go around your body hunting for, you know, pathogens or non-self kind of things that they can deal with. It even has been shown to increase the response to vaccination, which is particularly mm-hmm. relevant these days, where people who do some sort of physical activity, physical exertion around the time of vaccination seem to get a little bit better, immunogenicity or immune generating effects from vaccination compared to, you know, if you did that, you just like sat and did nothing. And so, you know, for our purposes, when we feel quote unquote sick, there are some considerations because you can be sick in a whole bunch of different ways. And some are, you know, pretty severe, debilitating, what we'd call febrile illnesses, where you have, you know, potentially high fevers and things where you're, you know, more likely to be pretty significantly contagious. And those are things where, yeah, might not be wise to go and do a particularly lengthy, particularly hard training session. It doesn't mean that you're better off doing nothing and being completely sedentary. Like movement is not going to set you back or harm you, but you also have to consider the environment that you'd be doing this exercise in. Would you be exposing other people to what you have? That's generally a bad look if you can avoid that versus if you have a garage like I do to go, you know, it takes a lot for me to say, I'm not even going to go out there and do anything, even if it's like an empty bar thing or hop on the air bike or do some isolation work or something. I'd have to be in pretty bad shape to even say I wasn't going to do that. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's the same. If I had a home gym, I probably still would have missed on Tuesday.
That bad, huh?
I mean, basically every time I stood up, I was very, very nauseous. And yeah. I was like, and throwing up, honestly, for me is the worst. I'd rather have a fracture or like whatever, because I can't stand it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm in agreement, you know. The data here, it's not nothing, but the problem with illness, particularly infectious illnesses, is that there's so many different infections that you can get. So like saying a generalized statement like exercise reduces the risk of infection, it's like, okay, but which infections? And it's like, right. We have data on mononucleosis. So the Epstein-Barr virus is one of the main causes of that, like a bunch of different herpes viruses, chickenpox, etc. So we feel reasonably confident that like regular exercise actually reduces the risk of infection with those agents, but not all infectious agents. We know that exercise increases, like you said, the response to vaccinations, greater antibody titers is how they measure that. Exercise is good. Nobody's disputing that. When should you not exercise? I agree. It's like if you're posing an infectious risk to people, yeah, probably would avoid that. And then if you feel like you're not an infectious risk, but you're feeling so bad that actual movement for you is just not something that you can tolerate. Yeah, well, I don't have to tell you to not exercise. You're just not going to do it. You know, I would try to train if you can, but then this is just like a generalized statement. But if you honestly can't, like, okay, well, that's the time you're not going to train. It's not going to be a huge deal if you miss a session. The issue is that if you miss a bunch of sessions and this becomes like a obstacle or barrier for you to like continue the healthy behavior. Pattern that you were engaged in, if that was your routine, if you were going at a certain time every day, and now like, you know, you're missing a bunch of sessions, that's probably the real risk. I don't care if you miss a day in the gym, you know, or 2 days. That's not a huge deal, provided you just can get back on it. But a lot of people, what'll happen is they'll get sick, and then, you know, a few missed sessions beget many missed sessions, and they're like, I haven't been in the gym in a week or a month. And it's like, well, probably didn't need to do all that. You know,
and there's a lot of reasons why that can happen. I think within our community, within our audience, one particularly prevalent way, a reason why that can happen is the reasons of why people train and their kind of where their values are. And so what I mean by that is for people who view the absolute weight on the bar as being like the determinant of the value of a training session. Right. So if you say this workout is only worthwhile if I can exceed what I did last time, or what I did last week, for example, then the natural conclusion is, oh, if I'm sick, I'm not going to be able to beat what I did last session or last week. And so this session would therefore be worthless and I'm going to skip it until I feel well again. And then when you come back, you're going to be weaker and then you're going to beat yourself up because you're, yeah. And then you're going to quit or something like that. Right.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for our perspective, the training itself is enjoyable and valuable to us. We, you know, it's something that keeps us coming back. And I also don't necessarily dichotomize like sedentary behavior versus training as like these two distinct things. It's all just like a spectrum of movement. And so even when I felt, you know, the first day I felt, you know, particularly bad, you know, when I had my bout with food poisoning last month, you know, the first day when it was at its worst, I still went out to my garage and I think I like RDL'd 135 or something like that. It's like a trivial weight, but I was moving it around and I just view that as like some movement. It was, you can call it, you know, quote unquote training or whatever, these were exercise and training, this stuff that people get all worked up about, but it's just movement and it's what I wanted to do. And ultimately I felt fine and I felt better and like more accomplished after doing that compared to if I had just like lounged around. Now, if you're like you said, you can't even tolerate like getting up and walking across your house to go do that because you have bad vertigo or you're actively vomiting. Yeah, that's a different story. But that session still had value in many ways, I would say, both psychologically, physiologically, made me feel better. May have altered the duration of how long I felt bad.
Yeah.
May have mitigated, or prevented some soreness that I would have experienced otherwise, you know, a couple of days later, had I skipped that session. Hard to know some of all those things, but, I wouldn't really, that's kind of how I would aim to shift people's views on this is like sessions where you don't keep adding weight to the bar every time or every week or something like that. They still have plenty of value. And I think people's like lower bound for where a session becomes not valuable is probably too high, meaning that you can still get value out of tons of sessions, even if the load goes down markedly.
Yeah. The only reason I know about this is because I'd recently gotten in an internet argument with some health professionals that were advocating that if you're sick above the head I don't even know what the thing is. It's like, if you're sick above the head, you can't exercise. If it's below the neck, you're fine or something like.
Just made up. Yeah.
Just 100% made up. I don't even remember because I remember looking at it and go, this is just made up.
Yeah.
And so invariably when challenging them on this, because I was like, why are you putting this out there? This is not helpful to anybody because again, it's just made up. It's just providing another barrier or for people to be physically active. And again, just telling people to rest without any sort of nuance. They were like, well, what about the myocarditis risk, viral myocarditis from people have like a viral infection and then they exercise. There's mouse data showing that there's an increased risk of viral myocarditis. There's a few case reports in the literature. And I was like, all right, cool. So there is a non-zero risk of getting viral myocarditis after a viral infection, period.
Yes.
Does that increase with exercise? And we don't have data showing that it does. The existing data is like, sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. Exercise doesn't appear to be this like, you know, certainly not a markedly increased risk. You may exacerbate or increase the risk of being diagnosed with viral myocarditis if you're very active because you're going to become symptomatic sooner than if you're just lounging around.
Yeah, you're more likely to notice. You're like, hey, this thing that I'm used to being able to do, I might not. But
correct.
I mean, I've diagnosed lots of viral myocarditis in people. I have a selection bias because I see patients in the hospital. So the sickest people are the ones who come to me. I wouldn't say it's something that's hugely prevalent, but of the cases that I see, it's typically in people who just got sick and then they develop this thing and they're, you know, not, you know, hard training or super active or even particularly sedentary. They're just normal people living their lives. And there's some risk of that happening with effectively, you know, most like I would say respiratory viruses can precipitate something like that, but it's not something that's worth being worried about or considering for like really anybody out there as far as would this change what I do? If
no,
I
100% no,
it does not.
No, that's what I'm saying. I was trying to think of conditions where I was like, I absolutely would not recommend somebody to train. And I was like, if you had like splenomegaly from like a really gnarly bout of mono, maybe, I guess. But then I'm like, I just don't know that I would tell you to not move. like don't do any physical activity.
Yeah. Those typically relate to impacts. Yep. Yeah. And for people who have already developed myocarditis or pericarditis, sometimes there can be some exercise limitations placed on those folks. Although those are from opinion based guidelines. But preemptively, like, oh, I got a cold, I better not exercise, otherwise I'm going to get this thing. No, that's not really the thing that is worth being worried about.
Yeah. Consider the infectious risk that you're putting people at. If you're able to like ambulate to the gym, I would exercise. And again, I'm not dichotomizing exercise and training. I'm just saying I would go to the gym, whatever your training set, your session was supposed to be. I would start out with the plan that you're going to do that without any modification. But if fatigue is notably higher, you're using RPE or some other sort of auto-regulation mechanism like reps in reserve or bar velocity or whatever you're using at the time, can shift the load on the bar, can change how much volume you're doing, right? If you notice like, hey, typically I'm able to do, or the workout says I'm supposed to do 5 sets of 5. And after your second set of 5, for example, that's already at a lighter weight because your fatigue has moved even slower and you're like, wow, my fatigue levels are higher. Just like go to the next exercise. Effectively, you would use auto regulation the whole way through to like determine what you're going to do. Also, if you feel not great, but you're like, I'm going to go do something, maybe you can push back a high priority session to you. If you are, you know, if you're like, I'm supposed to comp squat, comp bench, it's a squat bench deadlift day.
Yeah.
Maybe
just
you
trade move that.
Yeah. To something else. Oh, I'm doing leg press, feet up bench and, you know, pull ups or whatever. If you care, that's again, I mean, it's just like if you were in meat prep or whatever, or you like the sessions really, really mattered. If you do have a prolonged illness though, and you're like out of the gym for a substantial period of time, or you haven't been training for a long period of time, that would probably be the time to take a deload, which I want to talk about briefly, because we get a lot of questions on like, when is it time to take a deload? What is a deload? How do you do a deload, etc.? So like, what is a deload? A deload is a period of reduced loading, hence the terminology. The goal there is to preserve existing fitness adaptations while reducing fatigue. Sometimes you'll hear this referred to as like a low stress week, a pivot, washout. A taper is technically a deload as well. You're reducing loading in an effort to dissipate fatigue without decaying any of those existing fitness adaptations, so your performance potential goes up. This can last for days to weeks. The reason why you do it after like an acute period of either reduced training or absence of training is because effectively you've reduced your tolerance to training. And so like if you were to jump right back in to a high volume, high intensity program, that might not work out very well for you. You might be overstepping your current tolerance for training. So in my example, I missed one day this week. I don't need like to take a deload week. But if I had missed the rest of the week, like really just laid up, the idea of me jumping back into, all right, you got 9 sets of 3 on squat and 14 singles on bench. It's not that I couldn't have done it at some weight. It's just that as programmed, I would have had to modify something to like get back into that. So which would be a deload. You can reduce the intensity, you could reduce the volume, or you could reduce both. It kind of just depends on why you're doing it. So that brings up the next question is like, when would you take a deload? And the way I like to think about this, there are three like main like reasons: physiological, psychological, and then logistical. So from a physiological standpoint, if you're super sore, pain is increasing, anything like that, and you're like, man, you're just feeling super beat down and it's persistent. It's not just like one day. If it's one day, I'm not worried about it. But if it's like, yeah, for the last 2 weeks, I've noticed increasing soreness that's not dissipating, you know, over the course of a week. I'm not adapting to this. For example, it's just getting worse. Pain is getting substantially worse. Those would be reasons to consider a deload. And that's usually coinciding with a sustained performance drop. Like all my estimated 1RMs are going down. My top sets weights are going down. Yeah. Psychologically, like if your motivation to participate in the activity is waning because everything's a grind, or you're just not seeing the results that you want to see because of maybe these physiological symptoms. If environmental stress is high, it's like, oh, it's finals week and my you know, priorities are elsewhere. Those would be good reasons. And then the final part is like this logistical thing. So if there's a change in training goals, if you're like, all right, I'm switching from a strength focused block to hypertrophy focused block, or I want to do a block of endurance training, you got a meet coming up, traveling, vacation, whatever, where you have reduced access to the gym or reduced time to spend in the gym. Those would all be good times to do a deload. So again, you can, any one of those things, but that's when I'm typically communicating with clients, I'm like, either they'll ask for one. Because we have this relationship where they feel like they can communicate about their training. They don't just feel like I have to do it, otherwise coach is going to be disappointed. They're like, hey, I think I need a deload. And then I ask them like, hey, thank you. Or tell them, hey, thanks for the feedback. What's making you say that? Like what's going on? And I kind of just want to figure out like, is this physiological? Like, am I, hammering them with maybe too much? Is this like an acute environmental stress thing, something outside of the training? Is this motivational? And I'm not trying to separate the mind from the body here. I'm just kind of like, where is this coming from?
It might have an impact. For example, if you come back after the deload, do you get them back into something similar because it may have been working well, but they just got to, accumulate a little too much fatigue? Or if it's, more of a monotony or a motivation or an interest or something like that, then you're like, okay, when we come back from this deload, I'm going to need to do change some other things up to keep them engaged and enjoying the process.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? It's like,
it's all based on subjective feedback from the client. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So as far as how to do this, again, you can lower the volume. So that's reps times sets. Or if you're talking about endurance deload, just duration, and or the intensity. It really just depends on how, like why you're doing it. And then what's the goal for the subsequent training. So basically if you're keeping a similar training, emphasis or priority. So I'm going from one strength focused block to another strength focused block. I'm going to tweak the volume, tweak the exercise selection. I'm going to do whatever, but I do need this period of lower stress because I'm feeling beat up, performance is going down, motivation is waning, whatever. Then I would do something like, let's say you were doing previously five sets of five, I would do one set of five or two sets of five at a similar load. The whole goal is to preserve, again, these fitness adaptations while reducing fatigue. So literally cutting the volume down, by a substantial amount would do that. That's one way to swing it. If you're changing training goals, you're going from, this is a general strength development block to like a specialization phase to get ready for a meet. You would go from, again, that same five sets of five example to doing like a single at seven or eight and then three sets of two at 80%. Or something like that, or even just a single at seven. I mean, the whole thing is, again, where are you going next and how is this training week setting you up for that? Yep.
Yeah.
The other way to do it, and this is kind of how I personally do most of my pivot weeks, like just for myself or deload weeks or low stress weeks. If I'm moving to a similar block, but just with changing maybe the total load or exercises, I'll do this, I just call it a washout, where I'm picking different exercises and rep schemes. The idea is like, all right, I have no expectations for these exercises or just relatively low expectations because I'm not familiar with them. I am avoiding any sort of overuse kind of thing because these are totally different exercises. So I'm not just hammering the same thing over and over again. And it's just less importance. So I'm just like, I'm going to the gym, not like trying to maximize my performance in the gym. I'm just going through the motions to, again, preserve those fitness adaptations. So it's like if I was previously just focusing on the low bar squat for somewhere between 4 to 6 reps, maybe now I'm going to do high bar back squat or front squats or safety squat bar squats for sets of 10, and work up to one set of 10, just different bench press. Instead of that, maybe I'll do overhead press or incline bench or feet up bench or Duffalo bar bench press, like whatever. You can literally pick anything. The whole thing is just pick a similar movement type but different exercise, change the rep scheme up, do it for a week, and then jump into your next training block. The last thing I'll say about this is it doesn't have to be a week long. It could be days or it could be multiple weeks. It really, again, it just depends. So like I think by convention, everything falls into week-long things, and the weeks always start on Sunday or Monday. That's just how a lot of people kind of set their life up. But what I have been doing with some clients is when they are saying, hey, I think I'm going to need a deload or like I'm feeling a little beat up, or, you know, or even logistically, we're like, hey, we're prepping for a meet. We're going to switch training focuses here. I'll have them have like a last high priority session on like a Monday. They'll have like a heavy squat and bench focus day on Monday. And then I'll do a deload for Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, or just the last two sessions of the week, for example. Or people who've had this like sustained psychological kind of thing where they're like, I hate it right now. Like, I don't know. And so at that point, I might stretch out a deload for 2 weeks, 3 weeks to try to like get them an entry point where I'm starting to enjoy stuff. There's less, you know, negative psychological associations with the gym. Same thing if someone has an injury, right? This might be a deload for a protracted period of time where you're working back into it. So there are no hard and fast rules. There are no strict rules about deloads. But I just think when conceptually you're thinking about when to do a deload, you do it when there are, physiological issues, or psychological issues, or logistical things coming up. And then overall, you're just going to reduce the volume and or the intensity. And there are many different ways to do this. It just kind of depends on the person's preferences and then how your style as a coach or programming. Do you do anything differently, or is that pretty much?
I'd say that the way I go about this is pretty variable. So for myself, I can't say that I've really done like a dedicated deload week in a very long time. I think Same. For like the past year or so, I've been doing a lot more of kind of a lower fatigue training approach and just being way more flexible with my load selection compared to what I would have done maybe a couple of years ago. And so there may be periods or sessions where the weight is a little bit less than the prior week or the prior session, but it doesn't end up extending to the entire week. And so that ties into what you were saying, that like, I think sometimes people do get too locked into this like 7 day weekly schedule that is made up in society. And I've had, when you're very well trained, very well conditioned, you have a high work capacity, all that kind of stuff, your recovery is relatively quick and good. And so, just because you start to build up some fatigue and feel beat down doesn't mean that, hey, let's say that last hard session was on a Friday, that you need that weekend off, the entire next week, the subsequent weekend off, and then the next Monday before you can get back to real training. That's, again, kind of an arbitrary duration. Rather, I tend to follow a lot more the subjective kind of athlete reporting. If they tell me, I'm feeling beat down, then I say, all right, we can back off for a couple sessions. I might modify, say, the next 1 to 2 sessions and then get a new kind of point of feedback and say, hey, are we feeling, are we popping back up again? Are we starting to feel better again? So sometimes I'll have people who do, 2 back off sessions, and then they're able to get back to regular training on the latter half of the next week, or it might even be 1, or they might say, I don't need the actual prescription to change. I'll just adjust the weight, and follow the programming as it's written and see how I feel, on the back end. So there's a ton of flexibility. Some folks similar to me, we have not needed any dedicated deload periods. Some people really seem to enjoy having a dedicated week where they can kind of feel like they can chill out both psychologically and physically. Hey, I'm approaching a test day, and then right after my test day, I'm going to be, going off to party for, a bachelor party or something like that. It's like, okay, well, that's a reasonable situation to do that. So like you said, there's no real rules here. A lot of it should be based on the athlete's subjective reporting and their kind of where they are in their training relative to a high priority event, if there is one, like a meet or something like that, and then kind of learning with them along the way what they respond well to, what they prefer, what they don't prefer. So I myself, like at this point, I really don't prefer like an entire quote unquote low stress week where like the volumes and intensities are low across the board for the whole week. I haven't done that in a long time in my own training. Yep. Some clients still want it. Some want it for part of a week. It's just super flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you're finding yourself regularly deloading like once a month, yeah, right? The old 5-3-1 kind of setup, yeah, or once every 5 weeks, I know a lot of this has to do with expectations about how the training block is going to go and like maybe your own personal capacity or limitations or whatever. But I would start to not question, but maybe just look a little more closely at the programming and like, why is it that we can predict when you need this deload, or why is that? Are we setting you up for that? Meaning that the training is not appropriate for you to have this sustained, successful, programming. that being said, like all of our templates have deloads and low stress weeks built in. And the idea is like, we know that we're trying to make these appropriate and useful for a wide, you know, general population who's into training with barbells. And it's like, you know, on average, people are going to need a deload, you know, every fifth week or sixth week or whatever. But an individual is not an average, right? And I don't have the ability to like adjust these based on individuals' preferences and needs and responsiveness. But like most of my clients now, we're deloading, taking an actual deload, you know, once every 2 months maybe.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like out of nowhere. Like you can't really predict it.
Sure.
It's more like, huh, that's all right.
Well, and oftentimes I start digging when I hear that, because oftentimes we can reveal, oh, this happened in my life, or, you know, so it's actually very often, you know, coinciding with stuff that's happening outside the gym. And then once that goes away, we see training performance like pop back up pretty nicely for a lot of folks. But yes, I'm glad, you know, if you hadn't anticipated that, because we can anticipate that question arising where people would say, well, the templates have these and they're in there. And,
yeah,
you know, it's a valid question, but I think it's important to recognize that, hey, there are numerous inherent limitations to a
sure.
template that's not individualized. And that's part of the contrast between that and the individualized kind of coaching relationship. And the other thing is, you know, we'll often get questions like, hey, I'm running this template and things are going really great and weight's going up every week and I'm set to do this deload or low stress week next week.
No,
do I need
going.
To do it or should I keep going? We're like, no, you're illustrating this very phenomenon of like, you're responding really well. You don't need the deal. You can keep doing the same, you know, weekly deal until you demonstrate that you need it or until something arises. And then, you know, that it's there as an option for you. These things are not, you know, you don't have to do what's on the paper just because it's on the paper or on the screen. These things are malleable and you can modify them to your needs and preferences and all that's fair game.
Yeah. I just want to give people a structure that's useful and kind of show people how we program. The actual new template is just my phone number. What I'm going to do is sell it and you can just text me and ask me and I'll just
ask me just what do.
Yeah. What do. Yeah. Figure it out. All right. So hopefully this podcast so far has been useful, but now this is what people really want to know. We should have led with this, just like hook people in the first few minutes. You know, everyone wants to know what you're reading, what you're watching, like what is Austin doing? Like that could be its whole Instagram account by itself. Did you just finish the book on the Sacklers?
Yeah. So Empire of Pain was one of the recent books that I read by Patrick Radden Keefe, which was excellent. And so that book is basically a history of everything that led up to the opioid epidemic in the US. And it kind of traces the family that ultimately owns Purdue Pharma, going all the way back to like the OG Sackler who immigrated to the US back in like the early 1900s. And it traces his family and his family tree and their kind of how they ended up getting into medicine and then, you know, pharmacotherapy and then pain meds and opioids in particular, and then the marketing schemes and all the stuff that led to the, you know, 90s, 2000s opioid crisis. So that was a very well done history for anybody who's interested in the topic. Strongly recommended. I think you read it too. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm about three quarters of the way through.
You're getting through it. Yeah.
Do you read multiple books at the same time?
Typically not. No.
Yeah.
Because I have a bunch of podcasts that that's the other, because I do a ton of medical podcasts to stay, basically I got to stay ahead of my residents and students. So I got to stay sharp.
Right, yeah.
So I do like one book at a time and then a bunch of podcasts to stay sharp on stuff there.
Yeah. So I usually have one book like Audible going at a time and then one like physical book that I'll like tote around or keep in a bathroom or something. So the other book I'm reading is Deep Work by Cal Newport. I've had it for a long time. And I think I read maybe the first chapter once, but then forgot about it. It's just a pretty cool book about doing important work and like how do in this very distractible environment. So, what about, are you I just started The Wire.
I think that was based on my recommendation. Yeah.
Yes. And then also I was like, I need something that I'm not going to be done with. Like, I want to have something to look forward to
yes,
watch for
yes.
a while. I feel like
yes.
it keeps going on forever.
Yeah, The Wire, no question, is my favorite TV series of all time. Watched it, you know, in the early 2000s, and watched it in med school with my wife. And then we recently actually rewatched the whole series just because it's fantastic. So for anybody who hasn't seen it, definitely would recommend.
Also, I don't know if you know this, Dr. Death. It's on NBC.
It's so they're turning it into a series?
Into a series. They did it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Or it's on Peacock, which is like NBC's like streaming service. Yeah.
I'm not paying for that shit.
Well, yeah. But also, what is it, 5 days from now? You know what's starting? The Olympics. Cue Olympic music right now. I'm so excited. Like, I'm bummed that there's not going to be fans there. And I'm also bummed that we couldn't, like, I just want to go to the Olympics. I don't, okay, let me be clear. I'm not competing in the Olympics. All right.
Right.
Like unless Nuance becomes like an Olympic sport, like there's no way that I'm getting there. But I would love to go there. It's Paris in 2024. It's LA in 2028. I feel like I'd go to LA.
We have some opportunities. Yeah.
100%.
Yep.
It's going to be so much fun. 621 US athletes going this year, which I feel like is a lot. And the most interesting thing is there's over a 40-year age spread between our youngest and oldest competitor. Huh. The oldest competitor, he's 57 years old, Philip Dutton. He's an equestrian, which is interesting because he's competed for Australia before, but now he's competing for the United States. Huh. So interesting how you can just change.
Yeah, right.
Moving on. And the youngest is Katie Grimes. She's 15.
Yep.
It's crazy.
She qualified, I think, in like the 400 or the 800 freestyle and swimming. I watched her race.
Yes.
Pretty cool.
Okay. So the trivia question is, who in Olympic history has the most Olympic medals?
I don't know.
No guesses.
No.
And you're a swimmer. I just feel like...
I feel like the obvious guess, but that's also like the only sport that I pay particularly close attention to.
You would have been right. That's why I threw you a lobber.
Yeah. Phelps, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 28 medals. Savage. 10 more than anybody else. Yeah. That's crazy. Also, shout out to Leah. Leah Lutz, another one of our barbell medicine coaches. She just got an invite today for IPF Bench Worlds.
All right.
Which are held in Kazakhstan.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Because I was like, when she sent me the text message, I was like, wait, where is Kazakhstan? Yeah. Anyway.
Why do they pick these places? I don't understand.
I don't know.
My understanding was Belarus was like pretty unsafe for like worlds to be at twice, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. If she goes, I might try to go. I just would otherwise never go.
Of course.
To Kazakhstan.
Sure.
But Russia's right there. That seems like it'd be a good time. Just imagine selfie getting like, you know, I don't know, man. I think that'd be cool to check out because I've never been there. And I don't know that we're going to schedule a barbell medicine seminar in Moscow anytime soon, but I'd check that out.
Yeah,
probably not. That's funny. Anything else?
I think that's it. Covered it.
Episode 148 with Dr. Austin Baraki here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Again, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Links to any of the stuff that we discussed in the podcast today are going to be in the description below. Before you guys head out of here, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we don't have to do this, you know, ad read at the beginning and end and middle of every podcast. We'll just keep bringing it to you for free. As more people listen, like, we'll just do it. Otherwise, like, we're going to have to start reading like different grooming products and like, you know, home testing stuff for medical, you know, stuff.
I think that's when I hang up the old headphones and mic.
Yeah, they're right. Then Austin retires and then it's just me. And honestly, nobody wants that. So, yes, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. And we'll see you guys next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.